From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Why would an opera singer ask her students to do this? Today, a voice lesson from Dolora Zajic, a dramatic mezzo-soprano who sung with the Metropolitan Opera for more than 25 years and directs the Institute for Young Dramatic Voices, designed for young singers with big or unusual voices. Opera can be thrilling to watch, but if you're a performer, it can be risky.
I remember trying to get some insurance once, and I asked, well, why is the insurance so high? And they said, well, opera singers are listed under circus performers.
Also, David Edelstein reviews 99 Homes, about a realtor who gets rich off foreclosures and a construction worker who enters a Faustian bargain with him. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, weeknights on Comedy Central. It's the same show you love, but with one teeny tiny difference. Introducing The Daily Show with new host Trevor Noah, weeknights on Comedy Central and on the Comedy Central app.
A week from this Saturday, on October 3rd, movie theaters around the world will show a live theater cast of the Metropolitan Opera's production of the Verdi opera Il Trovatore. It's the premiere of the 10th anniversary season of the Met's Live in HD. One of the stars of the production is Dolora Zajic, who specializes in Verdi. In fact, when Terry spoke with Zajic last year, they opened with a recording of her in an earlier Met production of Il Trovatore. We're going to listen back to that interview. Here's how Terry introduced it.
Something I couldn't have predicted happened to me recently. I fell in love with opera. Honestly, I wasn't prepared for it. I'd always avoided opera. That changed after I saw the 2011 film Margaret that included a scene where the characters go to the Met to see an opera. The opera excerpt in the film was so moving, I decided I had to see one myself. It took a while, but eventually I went to the Met in HD, the live Metropolitan Opera performances shown by satellite in movie theaters around the world. I've been hooked ever since. My guest, Dolora Zajic, has sung with the Met for 25 years. She's best known for singing Verdi. I love her voice, and she has interesting things to say about singing and teaching. She's the founder and director of the Institute for Young Dramatic Voices, which is designed for young singers with big or unusual voices. She didn't figure out that she could sing opera until after she was a pre-med student. Let's start with some very dramatic singing featuring Zajic as the gypsy Azucena in Verdi's Il Trovatore. It is one of those great opera plots. Her mother was burned at the stake on the orders of the count, who believed she bewitched his children. To avenge the murder, Azucena throws the count's son into a fire, only to realize that in her blind frenzy, it was her own son she'd burned alive. In this tormented aria, she confesses the truth to her adopted son. This was recorded at the Met in 2009. Dolora Zajic, welcome to Fresh Air. I love your singing. I'm very new to opera, and I think a lot of our listeners probably haven't heard much opera, so I'm going to be asking you to explain some things that you might take for granted. But I want you to describe what it feels like physically when you're singing that. because there's so much going on. You've got these power chords behind you that the orchestra is playing. You're duetting. You're getting higher and higher notes. It's really big and really deep and dark.
Well, you know, singing is connected to the body, so there's a depth in the body that's necessary to perform this kind of music. And a lot of that expression comes from a kinesthetic awareness. And that's one thing that I think that people identify with. And of course, there's the moment that you're in, and you don't have time to think, you don't have time to dwell on anything because you're in the moment. You have to be concentrating on what's happening right then and there.
But I'm thinking that there must be almost like physical sound waves that you're feeling, because...
No, you don't feel that.
No?
No. The audience hears something entirely different than what you feel.
Really? So what are you hearing different than what we're hearing in the audience?
Well, a singer's listening for focus. You're being expressive. There's sensations that you're feeling physically. It's a very visceral thing. Kinesthetic empathy is a very interesting ability. There was a famous Russian choreographer who went blind, and he was able to tell by how they sounded when he put his ear to the floorboards exactly the positions where their arms and their hands and their feet were. And he could tell exactly what their posture was because he had heard that sound so many thousands of times through the course of his years. And he was able to tell by how it sounded what they were doing with their bodies to achieve that sound. Singers have the same thing. You have to have that to be able to learn a vocal technique. That's one of the tests we use for younger singers when we're testing to see their ability to absorb a vocal technique. It involves putting a blindfold on them and you sing a vowel and see if they can duplicate it, like perhaps you sing an E. And then you do something different. You tighten the upper lip. You go, or you jut your jaw out. Let's say we tighten the upper lip. You start out on E, and then I go E. There's a little bit of difference in the sound. And someone with kinesthetic empathy is going to figure out what you did without seeing. And the more you have of that, either as an audience member or as a singer, the more you're going to connect in that way.
From the very little that I know about opera, I think of the dramatic mezzo-soprano and the parts that I've seen you in as being kind of like a character actor. In most of your roles in opera, you're not the girlfriend, you're the jealous woman. You're not the lovely nymph, you're the witch. You're not the woman having the affair with the king. You're the fortune teller who that woman goes to. You're Lady Macbeth. So do you think of yourself as a character actor in that respect?
I've become one, and I have enjoyed it. The thing is that mezzo-soprano usually gets the designation of that kind of character in an opera. Usually the soprano is the pure ingenue, and then you've got the noble tenor, and it's usually the baritone and the mezzo that have the evil parts, and sometimes it's the bass. And you get to do all these twisted and interesting people. I like doing those kind of people. There's a interesting evolution when you're acting a part like that. And it's, you know, it takes a lot of in-depth delving into your own self and finding what's in you. And it takes a harsh, objective look at yourself to be able to come to grips with those kinds of roles in the right way, I think.
So what about your range as a dramatic mezzo-soprano?
Well, a dramatic mezzo is very not quite, but almost a soprano in terms of range. It's a high mezzo, but you have to have low notes.
And you do.
Yes. I've been very fortunate.
So I want to play something else. And this is you with the Metropolitan Opera, recorded in November of 2012. And this is from the Verdi opera, Ballo and Maschera, which translates to Masked Ball. I ask for everybody's forgiveness with my pronunciations.
Okay, I'll stop you.
Yes. You're not forgiving me, I can see.
No. I'll do it slowly. Un ballo in maschera.
Un ballo in maschera. No, that was terrible.
No, that's okay. Say maschera.
Maschera.
Now say maschera.
Maschera.
But you want the accent on the ma. Maschera.
Maschera.
That's right.
Do I have to do this in order to love opera?
No, you don't.
Because I'm going to be hopeless if I have to,
no,
if I have to learn how to pronounce
fine.
Things to love opera.
No,
I'm going to
you're
going to
be fine. I'm doing it slow so you'll get it. Okay. Okay. So it's maschera.
Maschera.
Yeah. You got it.
Did you have to go through this when you started singing because you didn't speak
yeah,
all the
we all
languages?
Do. Yeah, uh-huh. We all do. Mm-hmm. You know, we all, it's a. In fact, the biggest chunk of operatic training is in linguistics and musicianship. It's not in vocal training.
No, really?
Yes.
Do you understand everything you're singing? I mean, like
absolutely.
I mean, word for word, as opposed to here's
word
the English translation.
Not only what I'm singing, but what everybody else is singing.
So you have to know a lot of languages.
But yeah, you
but mostly
know
Italian,
to know.
Right?
I sing in Italian, Czech, Russian, French, German, English.
Wow. Okay, so back to, I'm not going to say the title again. So in this, like you're a fortune teller. And introduce the aria we're about to hear.
Well, this is a very interesting aria because you can play this part one of three ways. And it depends on the slant of the stage director. You can play her as a woman who really believes that she is contacting Satan but isn't. She's just a dingbat. Or you can play her as someone who really is in cahoots with Satan. Or you can play her as a fraud and she's just part of some intrigue.
How do you see it?
Well, it depends on the stage direction. You see, that's the wonderful thing about opera is when something can be interpreted differently, there's a different take. As long as that's what's great. When I say that's what's great about the role, it means that each one is equally valid.
And in this version we're about to hear, how are you singing it?
As a dingbat.
How come?
Well, because she thinks she's connected with Satan and she just got lucky.
And what are you singing in this? Translate it for us.
I'm calling up the devil.
Okay.
I'm calling up the devil.
Well, I love your like warm, dark tone in this. So let's hear it. This is my guest, Dolora Zajac, singing with the Metropolitan Opera in 2012. Was my guest Dolora Zajac singing with the Metropolitan Opera in November 2012, an aria from Verdi's Un Ballo in Maschera, in which she played a fortune teller.
No, it's
you're going to correct me again.
No. Ooh. As, and who, like an owl.
I think you should just give up on me, honestly.
I'll say masked ball.
Yeah, the masked ball, right, because that's what it translates to. Thank you.
Yes. Okay.
So do you have a favorite or a most calamitous moment on stage that you would like to share?
Probably the most calamitous incident was the first time that we did Rusalka, and there was a mechanical cat on my shoulder, and I'm trying to find a motivation for saying, hop my cat 1,000 times. So we thought, well, it's digging its claws in your shoulder. And so, and I've got a spoon and I'm mixing stuff in the cauldron. So I hit it on the head and the head would stop for a second and then would continue moving and the tail would keep moving. Well, one day I hit the head too hard and the head fell off. But the tail kept moving. So I had to do this. I had to finish the scene with this headless cat and the tail kept with a moving tail. And I didn't know what to do with the head. So I just picked it up and threw it in the cauldron with the rest of the stuff. That got a lot of laughs.
That's funny, because you're the witch in Rusalka.
Yes.
No, it's really an interesting story how you became an opera singer, because you didn't even start singing until you were 22?
Almost 22.
Yeah, so I thought that opera singers were supposed to start singing when they were very young, and even if they weren't training in opera per se, that they were getting some kind of training.
I think that you will find, if you went around and asked all the opera singers at the very top of their profession, how old they were when they started, who they studied with, where they studied, you would get so many different answers that there is no one rule fits all. Singers actually used to begin singing at a much younger age than they do now. I would say, for me, I started late, but it's not unusual. I discovered I had a voice. I wanted to be a pianist when I was 7, and circumstances didn't allow that I studied it.
What does that
mean? So by the time, I didn't have access to a piano. So by the time I got to high school, I knew it was too late to be an instrumentalist. So I decided, well, I'll become a doctor and just, sing for fun. And when I was in college, I was in pre-med, and that's when I discovered I had a voice and that I actually had a crack at a singing career. And I decided to take the chance, and this is where I ended up.
So when you realized you had a voice, as you put it, and you started studying voice, what appealed to you about opera?
For me, it was just simply that I finally had a venue where I could be in classical music. If I had started when I was really young, I would probably have pursued the piano, and I probably would have been a coach or a conductor or something, or a composer. Although now I'm starting to compose anyway, so I ended up where I might have ended up anyway. So,
could you demonstrate for us one of the vocal exercises or techniques or something that you learned early on that has helped guide you and help discover the best qualities in your voice?
Well, here's a vocal exercise. It's very old. It's one of the Vidal exercises, and the purpose of it is to connect the support with the focus because they're inextricably linked. So it's a very strange exercise, but it works. So it goes something like this. Sounds something like that.
It sounds like you're doing it more nasally first and then more through your throat second?
Yes, it teaches you the difference between nasal and nasality, nasal resonance, which are two different things. And it also helps you isolate what you really need from one thing to the next so that the focus and the support are connected together so that you get a supported sound.
Is there another example, too, of something that, opened up your voice?
Well, opening my jaw. One of the things that I was taught is that a lot of modern singing today is people use their jaws and their lips more than they used to. And they used to do more with their tongue in the past. And so I was taught the older method. And the difference would be if you go, I'm going to do it the wrong way first, or what some people consider the right way today, and then I'm going to sing the way I do it, which is older school. So the first way is, and then my way would be,
well, that's a really big difference. And the second way, the way you do it is darker, fuller, more resonant?
Well, the second way, I don't use my lips. I use my tongue to create the vowels.
Uh-huh. Now, I've been asking you to demonstrate a couple of things. You actually direct a vocal institute for young people. It's called the Institute for Young Dramatic Voices. Who are the young people that you're seeking out for this institute?
Well, we're looking for singers that can sing that have the potential to sing Wagner, Verdi, or unusual voices, which we would consider basso profundos, true basses, contraltos. And we would take a dramatic coloratura if one came along, but we haven't really heard one yet.
So why are you focusing on unusual voices?
Well, because I think they're often the most misunderstood during their development. And we've got more people on the planet than we've ever had. Why do we have fewer dramatic voices? Something is happening that's cutting them off at the pass somewhere. And I've discovered where some of those places are. And one of them, I think we lose the largest amount at the high school level. And I think the reason for that is because they don't sing classical music as much as they used to. And the other reason is that when they do, the voice that matures and has a big sound usually does not fit into a high school chorus, a cappella choir. We had a young man who is a spectacular young bass who, when he auditioned, he had hardly any sound at all until he hit a low note or a high note. And I said, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. So I said, why don't you try this again? And I found out that there was an actual demarcation as to when it started sounding good again. Turned out the range where he had shut his voice down was singing out of tune and singing through his nose, where he was where he was trying to fit in with his a cappella choir. His voice was simply too big to fit in with adolescent voices.
Support for NPR comes from Bleecker Street, presenting the new film Pawn Sacrifice. In a gripping true story set during the height of the Cold War, American chess prodigy Bobby Fischer, played by Tobey Maguire, finds himself caught between two superpowers when he challenges the Soviet Empire. Also starring Liev Schreiber and Peter Sarsgaard, Pawn Sacrifice chronicles Fischer's terrifying struggles with genius and madness, and the rise and fall of a kid from Brooklyn who captured the imagination of the world. Now playing.
I've seen you in the Met in HD, in Rusalka. You know, it's kind of like when a show on public television, in the sense that at intermission, there's an interviewer, usually somebody who is with or has been with the Met, who interviews the leads, and then they interview the conductor and the director. And so, like, you're walking off, it's like you've just sung an aria. You know, it's the middle of the opera, and suddenly, like, you're being interviewed. And I'm thinking, God, that must be so hard to be in your, like, analytical, reflective frame of mind at the same time that you're in the middle of a performance, because it's just intermission.
Well, it's all part of the job.
Right. Well, what happened in Rusalka is that you were asked the question and your answer was something like this.
Well, that's because I was sick.
Yeah, you were sick. How did you sing?
Well, if your vocal folds, the vocal folds themselves are not affected and you can keep your lungs functioning, you can sing. If you've got all the rest, you know, stuffy nose, runny nose, if you've got, you know, all the other things, you can even have a really bad sore throat. But if your vocal folds are not affected or only slightly affected, you can still sing.
Well, first of all, when I have a cold of any sort, my voice sounds completely different, and I'm talking about speaking. And second of all, usually when I get a cold, I get hoarse or laryngitis. That doesn't happen to you?
Well, on occasion. Singers are experts at keeping things from dripping on their throats. Believe me.
How do you do that?
They're experts. Well, antihistamines, you know, making sure that when, you know, the position you sleep in, I mean, these things, they become habits. And you learn all the tricks. And usually the best things are the oldest things, like Hot steam.
Inhaling hot steam.
Hot steam before you sing. Tea with lemon and honey.
Well, let me just say, I said inhaling hot steam. I don't want to give the wrong impression. You're not.
You just turn on a shower, you
right?
Know?
I don't want people to like burn their respiratory systems.
No, you just turn on a shower on hot water, and it eventually steams up the place, and you just breathe it in, and it helps clear things out very quickly. Mm-hmm. And also, a lot of vocalises clear out a lot of phlegm. You know, when I do that V-Doll exercise, it basically cleans out my sinuses, and it also pushes out phlegm from my lungs. And so you basically hack the phlegm out, and you get the nasal congestion gone by draining, and you know, and then you, after, you know, the antihistamine is like when you sleep, so it doesn't drip on your cords when you sleep. But when you're singing, you can't sing with an antihistamine. So,
and what position do you sleep in to prevent post nasal drip?
On my stomach.
No, really?
Yeah.
Wow, that seems so uncomfortable.
Well, not if you have a pillow.
Okay. Still seems really uncomfortable.
Singers, you know, it's amazing what can become a habit or what you're willing to put up with if it's part of your job. It's amazing. I mean, I've sung with a broken shoulder and broken ribs. And
like,
oh, yeah.
How can you breathe if you have a broken rib?
It's easy.
I mean, breathe that kind of way you have to breathe.
Well, the adrenaline shoots through your body, and you don't feel it when you're performing. After is a whole nother story, but a lot of singers get injured on the job. I remember trying to get some insurance once, and I asked, well, why is the insurance so high? And they said, well, opera singers are listed under circus performers because apparently there's a high injury rate for opera singers.
Did you injure yourself on stage?
Oh, yeah. I fell in the prompter box at the dress rehearsal of Rusalka the first time we did it. And I broke two ribs and tore a ligament in my leg. And
that wasn't this time around, was it?
No. This is the first time we did it.
Okay.
And then fortunately, I had a cane in a stick in the show, so it didn't matter.
Right. Yeah, you had a big stick as a cane earlier this year.
So that works fine.
Wow, okay.
This episode of Fresh Air and the following message are made possible by NatureBox.com on a mission to make smart, delicious snacking easy. From honey Dijon pretzels to spicy sriracha roasted cashews, NatureBox delivers over 100 bold, satisfying choices right to your door. And all NatureBox snacks are made with high-quality ingredients and zero artificial nonsense. At work or at home, NatureBox gives you a range of ways to indulge your snacking needs. Visit naturebox.com now and enjoy your first box on them.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Delora Zajic. She is a dramatic mezzo-soprano. She's sung a lot of Verdi over the years. She's been with the Metropolitan Opera for over 25 years. Let's hear some more music. I want to play something from your album, The Art of the Dramatic Mezzo-Soprano, and I thought we could hear from the Verdi opera Don Carlo, the aria that you're saying, O Don Fatale. Tell us something about this aria.
Well, this is basically where she curses her fatal gift that got her into trouble, her vanity and her beauty. And she basically is bemoaning the fact that she's got to go to a convent. She's been given the choice of exile or the convent. And the reason for this is that she incriminated the queen by putting a portrait of Don Carlo in her jewelry box, which her husband, Philip, found and accused her of infidelity. And for her punishment, she has been given this choice by the queen.
Okay. So this is Delora Zajic, and we'll hear Charles Rosencrantz conducting the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra.
Oh,
Dolores Ogic from her album, The Art of the Dramatic Mezzo-Soprano. And that is dramatic. I think one of the things that makes your singing so dramatic is the very kind of dramatic rhythms that you sing.
Well, I did play percussion in high school.
Oh.
That
makes sense.
I have a good sense of rhythm. And I think that there's a lot that can be expressed in a tempo change and in a tempo itself. And I really believe that rhythms can help create a big presence. You know, sometimes a musical imagination is as important as singing itself, you know, the voice, what you do vocally, the vowels. So there's a percussiveness that can sometimes be quite energizing and useful in singing as an expressive device.
One of the things you have to do when you sing, especially with singing the kind of powerhouse stuff that you do, you have to learn how to relax your tongue and your jaw. And it's almost counterintuitive, because I think usually if you're doing something that requires a lot of effort, you just kind of naturally tense up. I'm not saying you should tense up, but it's kind of what people do. And probably for untrained singers, it's the same thing, that you just kind of like tense up. How did you learn to not tense up? And to
you
keep...
You just don't.
Sure, that's easier said than done.
It is easier said than done, but that's exactly what you do. You learn to let go and stop trying to do too many things and figure out, isolate what you really need in order to function. A perfect example, if you compare a amateur weightlifter with a professional one, the amateur one, his neck is straining and he's using all these extra muscles and he's grunting and all kinds of things. And if you look at a professional, his whole body is relaxed, even the hand that is holding the weight. But he will be exercising only the muscles that are meant to be worked. And that's the difference that you find, because they're very specific, because they want to develop that particular set of muscles over, say, this set of muscles. So what they do is they've learned how to isolate. And that's the real key.
Is there an exercise that you give your students to help them learn how to relax and only use the muscles that they need?
Well, there's two approaches. One is to replace it with something else. And the other one is just to get them to let go. And it, you know, and different personalities require different things. You know, for a control freak, getting them to let go is hard. But it's essential. I remember when I finally figured out how simple one aspect of singing was, and I looked at my voice teacher and I said, "Is that all it is?" And he put his head on the piano keys and he said, "Why do I do this to myself?" And the next time I had a lesson, there was a sign on the piano. It said, "Thank you for not singing."
So, what was the thing that you figured out?
Oh, I just figured out I had to just open my mouth. Now, that is easier said than done. But just to relax your mouth and open it the right way. Just let it drop open. I mean, that is more difficult for more people than you would think. Another one is just relaxing the tongue. Now, if your jaw is in the right place, it automatically puts the tongue in the right position. And then just learning to figure out what your tongue is really doing when it's relaxed. The best way to tell somebody how to figure out how to relax the tongue is to just say, well, notice where it is when you aren't doing anything. That's the relaxed tongue. It's not about putting it somewhere. It's about letting it be where it wants to go.
One of the exercises you give some of your students is, it kind of sounds to me like Mongolian throat singing.
Yeah, it is. It's the Kumi style. And what we've discovered is, because it focuses on isolating resonances, is it teaches them about focusing resonance and formants and connecting that with support immediately. It speeds up the learning process tremendously. So we are now teaching it to all of them, and the results have been actually quite remarkable. I had no idea it would speed things up so quickly.
Can you demonstrate for us what it is? Not
sure.
All of our listeners will know.
Well, what you do is you have a fundamental pitch, and then with your tongue, the middle of your tongue, you bring out different resonances, different pitches. So an example would be this. Anyway, that's a sample.
No, that's wonderful. And the overtones that you get from that are so unusual and eerie. And so what does that teach you? And do you want overtones like that when you're singing?
What it teaches you is that resonance is all manipulated between the middle of the tongue and the hard palate. That's where all the work takes place. Now, you can use sensing devices, but they're not. It's not doing something. I mean, some people say sing in the masks, put it out in front of your face. There are many different, sing like there's a spot between your eyes. These all focus on sensations. And they're useful, but it's only part of the process. And people have different sensations. I mean, somebody might not feel it between the eyes, but they might feel it in a different part of their body. And they're not always reliable. They shift around on you. But hearing focus is always, you'll always hear it the same way. So when it comes to focus, you have to shift the gyroscope to the ear. When people say that someone is listening to themselves too much, they're usually talking about other things, like they're slowing it down and they're not keeping up the beat, or they are, or they've gone into the back of their mouth and it sounds big on the inside, but there's no. Size on the outside, and it's actually got less focus. So focus is something you have to hear in a very specific way.
So you're in your early 60s now. How long do you think you'll be able to sing professionally?
Well, I probably got 5 years of major roles at this present level, and then maybe some featured medium-sized roles for another 5 to 10 years after that, if I choose to do that. I mean, Mother Nature is definitely going to take a big chunk. I mean, that's just inevitable. I mean, we all age, and the time, you know, I can see it. I can see it coming, and then I will gauge my downsizing accordingly. That's just the nature of the beast. It's not happening now. I don't want people to think that all of a sudden it's happening now. I just see the approaching line coming. That's all.
Right.
And I want to leave in my prime. I don't want to leave a sorry spectacle before people. I want to leave at a respectable level.
Yeah. When you're singing on stage at the Met, what is the importance of the conductor for you during the performance?
Well, of course, a conductor is terribly important. He has to be really good at what he does. But to me, the most important person is the audience and the composer. The rest of us, and even the composer, is a servant to the audience. And, of course, the audience is a servant to the higher art. So, you know, you can argue about that. But the thing is that the bottom line, we're serving the audience. So the conductor is serving the audience. The singer is serving the audience. The stage director is serving the audience. Even the composer is serving the audience. That's who we wrote it for. And so that is the most important person.
Well, Dolores Audrick, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Mezzo-soprano Delora Zajic spoke with Terry Gross last year. The Metropolitan Opera begins its season tonight, and Zajic will return in her role as the Gypsy in a production of Verdi's Il Trovatore. A theater cast of this production will be shown in movie theaters around the world on Saturday, October 3rd, as part of the Met Live in HD series. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the new film 99 Homes. This is Fresh Air.
Before we get back to Fresh Air, I want to tell you about a new NPR podcast called Hidden Brain with Shankar Vedantam. It premieres September 22nd with an episode exploring a phenomenon called switch tracking, when two people think they're talking about the same thing, but in reality are speeding down separate tracks. It usually does not end well. You can subscribe to Hidden Brain on the NPR One app, iTunes, or at npr.org/podcasts.
The son of Iranian immigrants, writer-director Ramin Barani won a following with his indie films Man Push Cart, Chop Shop, and Goodbye Solo. He was called the new great American director by the late critic Roger Ebert, to whom Barani dedicates his latest film. It's called 99 Homes and stars Michael Shannon as a realtor who gets rich off foreclosures and Andrew Garfield as his reluctant employee. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
The most powerful morality plays work like drama instead of melodrama, so you're not just on the side of the victim. You also see the world through the eyes of the oppressor. Wall Street did that, although Oliver Stone made the devil mentor of the wide-eyed protagonist, Gordon Gekko, so charismatic that a generation of money men adopted him as a role model. Ramin Barani's 99 Homes works on the same principle, with one key difference. The villain is Rick Carver, a predatory Florida realtor played by Michael Shannon. But the guileless apprentice he corrupts begins as one of his victims. That victim is Dennis Nash, played by Andrew Garfield. Nash is a skillful builder, but the market has fallen out of the construction business, and he barely gets work. He takes out a loan he can't repay on the house in which he lives with his mom, played by Laura Dern, and his young son. Early on, he fights foreclosure before a brusque judge. Then comes a knock at the door, the sheriff, and behind him, Carver.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I'm Deputy Anderson with the Sheriff's Department, and we're here to serve you with a court-ordered eviction.
Okay, well...
So, sir, ma'am, do you have any weapons on your body or anywhere in the house that we need to know about?
No. Not us.
Mr. Carver?
Good morning, sir. Ma'am, my name's Rick Carver. I'm a licensed real estate broker.
Mr. Carver.
Rick? Hi.
And I'm very sorry to tell you that this home has been foreclosed on and officially transferred to the bank. And I'm going to need you to please vacate the premises.
No, I understand what you're saying, Mr. Carver, and we've been getting our eviction notices. I was in court yesterday.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the judge informed me that I got 30 days to file for an appeal, and that's what I intend to
do. Well, if you posted bond and you have an emergency stay signed by the judge, you're welcome to remain.
I got a question. You guys didn't get any rescheduling of the
eviction date. What I received is a court order signed by a judge. It says you are to vacate these premises today.
We were scared of
this. This home is owned by the bank.
That scene goes on and on. The handheld camera swerves with the characters as the mother cries out in grief and Nash pleads and argues. Barani presents this as a primal violation. Owning a home in the U.S. is hugely freighted with issues of self-worth. I found the scene so excruciating, I had to get up and walk around the back of the theater. 99 Homes turns on an improbability you just have to go with. Carver takes a shine to Nash, who proves himself by taking charge of the cleanup of a house where the evicted owners deliberately backed up the septic tank. Soon, Carver's giving Nash loads of money to strip foreclosed homes of appliances and later carry out evictions. The carrot is that if Nash makes enough, he can buy back his home. The audience is in a tough spot, rooting for Nash to succeed and cringing as he does unto others what was done unto him. 99 Homes evokes a 2010 scandal, a spate of so-called robo-signed Tampa Bay area foreclosures, sometimes fraudulent, with judges rubber-stamping evictions and law firms reaping millions in fees. In the best devil mentor tradition, Shannon's Carver explains to a conscience-stricken Nash his worldview.
You think America 2010 gives a flying rat's ass about Carver or Nash? Mm-mm. America doesn't bail out the losers. America was built by bailing out winners, by rigging a nation of the winners, for the winners, by the winners. You go to church, Nash? You go to church?
Sure.
Only 1 in 100 is going to get on that ark, son. And every other poor soul's gonna drown. I'm not gonna drown.
I love Shannon. He has an antsy, wild man vibe, but he's a disciplined actor, marvelous in the theater. He makes Carver a man who has channeled his demons with startling efficiency. But as you can tell from Carver's speech, 99 Homes is sometimes written with a heavy hand, and Garfield, though hardworking, overplays Nash's feelings of guilt. He doesn't want the audience to hate him, even for a moment, so when he evicts people, he looks as distraught as they do. Fortunately, Laura Dern makes Nash's mother so decent and unaffected that you understand her son's reluctance to tell her the source of his cash. You know you're damned if you can't tell your mom what you do for a living. 99 Homes builds to a predictable but smashingly effective climax. Barani makes you understand how this poisonous financial ecosystem thrives. His early films, among them Man Push Cart and Chop Shop, were lucid studies of people on the outside of society. Here, he shows that in an economic climate this unstable, everyone fancies him or herself an outsider, liable to be victimized, and can justify any bad deed. Even the evictors fear they're one step away from eviction.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. On Monday's show, A Day in the Life of an Oncology Nurse, we hear from Teresa Brown, author of the new memoir, The Shift. Brown's first book, Critical Care, chronicling her first year as a nurse, is used as a textbook at many nursing schools. Before becoming a nurse, Brown was a professor of English. Hope you can join us then. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.